So that was, it was inspirational, and certainly Muhammad Ali was. Next thing, you're on his bill, and you're meeting him, and you're fighting on his undercard, stuff like that, and you're up there as well. And you don't really see that transition, you know, from where you were to where you are, or you're getting there, because you're still driving.
How much did that night of the first fight take out of you emotionally and psychologically and physically, that 15-round fight?
Well, it was the party afterwards, really.
Drained the life out of you.
It wasn't the fights. They were easy. But it was the party, and afterwards took it out of me, I bet.
So were you content with your boxing career when you retired? Did you think that you'd fulfilled your potential and done all that you could have done?
No. I didn't feel that, and I don't feel that now. I got to a point. I'm an alcoholic, you know? So I got to alcoholism, And so I got to a point where one drink was too many, 100 wasn't enough.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Chris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
I said, he's bitten me. He said, well, let me pull you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
My guest this week is British boxer royalty Liverpool's John Conte. John retired back all the way back in 1980 after beating James Dixon via stoppage. That was one of 34 wins, 24 KOs or 24 early wins, four losses, one stoppage defeat and one draw. The draw to Jesse Burnett. Two of the losses came to Matthew Saad Mohammed, and John was of course part of that glittering 1970s crop of light heavyweights that spawned the likes of eventually Michael Spinks, Dwight Cowie, Eddie Mustafa Mohamed, Mike Rossman, Victor Galindez, Matthew Saad Mohamed. The list is endless. James Scott. I could go on and on and on. As anyone knows, you can actually go back via these podcasts and listen to interviews that I've done with Yaki Lopez and Eddie Mustafa Mohamed, building quite a good little collection of 70s heavyweights for this podcast, and of course British boxing royalty, which John is. You know, quite often he's referred to as the greatest ever fighter from these shores. Some refer to him as the most talented, some refer to him as an enigma, while others think that he didn't fulfill his potential, and here in his own words, he'd agree with that. I had a good time chatting with John. I'm not sure how he thought it went. Hopefully he enjoyed it. You know, I ask some of the harder questions. And obviously when I speak to people like John, he's trying to recall stuff, or I'm trying to get him to recall stuff that happened near on 40 years ago, which it's a little, or sometimes more. You know, he won the title back in 1974, so 46 years ago. That's quite a big ask for someone to go back into the memory bank that far. But I think he did an outstanding job. It was great to chat to him. I get asked for these British boxing icons quite regularly, be it, who do I get asked for? So the likes of Ken Buchanan, likes of Lloyd Hannigan, Kirkland Lang, Nigel Benmore recently, obviously. John H. Tracy, I get asked for quite a bit. All these guys, Charlie Magri, all these guys I'd love to get on the podcast, and hopefully will do in good time. It was great to get John. Weirdly, having said after Tony Dodson last week that I hope to get more guys from Liverpool on, obviously back-to-back Scousers. Really good to speak to John. Really enjoyed it. And some of your questions I thought were brilliant for John. It was great to be able to put some of them to him at the end of this podcast. What a run it's been, though, through lockdown. Without naming all of them, I'm thinking Mikael Kessler, I'm thinking Andy Lee, Alex Arthur, Larry Merchant, George Foreman, and now John Conte. It's been a terrific run. I've really enjoyed this run in lockdown. But next week, I will be back delivering you a podcast that I've done in person, all being well, and I'll tell you who's coming later on in the show as we wrap things up. But safe to say, I'm looking forward to getting back out there and doing some more of these face to face. John was done via Zoom, but I thought the sound was okay, and it was great to chat to him, and it's great to have his life story in this back catalogue. Now we're into the 90s, heading into that sacred 100th episode. And thank you all for sticking with us, and if you're new to us, thanks for giving us a shot. This podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm in 2020. That was at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they can help you retain them, and you can find out more about them at hansonlee.com. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs, and you can find out more about them at delcosafety.co.uk. But now, here's the brilliant John Conti.
So we've spoken a few times in the past, but this is a massive thrill for me because I'm such a massive fan of the light heavyweight era that you were part of from the mid to late 70s and into the early 80s, when people do call it the golden era of the 175 pounders because the talent division was so deep.
Yeah, it was a great area. I said earlier then, I meant earlier. There's another era.
Was there an error coming along at that time?
Sorry, I've done well there. I've done 2 minutes without putting a scouse gag in.
So tell me a bit about what it was like being part of that bunch. And obviously, I'm referring to Matthew Saab Mohammed, Eddie Mustafa, Mike Rossman, Galindez, yourself, Yaki Lopez, James Scott, Dwight Carwey. You could go on and on and on.
Yeah, it was a great time, you know, 1971 when I turned pro with Georgie Francis, my manager, and he got me the titles over here, the European and then the World Championship as well, against Jorge Amada in 1974. And then the defences, you know, Yaki Lopez was one.
It was a minefield of a division, though. There were no easy fights back then, were there?
No, I don't think so. You manage it, line them up, and you just done them, you know.
If we can, let's rewind to when you first went to the gym. I believe you were 10 or 11 at the time. What took you to the gym in the first place?
Yeah, my dad. He took me to the gym. There was 10 in our family, 10 kids. We had 8 boys, 2 girls, and I was the 4th eldest. And he introduced us all to the gym, you know, not the girls. He would do now, I suppose. Yeah, not then. But and they all done a bit at Kirby Amateur Boxing Club, and but I was the one that committed myself to it totally. And I remember him teaching me a double left hook, hook to the body and a hook to the chin, my dad, when I was at home before he took me to the gym. And I'd get them onto the body and he just leaned back as I was coming up with the left hook to the chin, kept missing them. But after some time, about 6 months, came up quick, you know, and I caught him fast, you know, caught him. And he said, well, I think you're ready for the gym now. And then he took me down to Kirby Amateur Boxing Club, where he had my two trainers, Charlie Atkinson, Tucker Edmondson, Tommy Singleton, Joey Singleton, ex-lightweight. I think he was lightweight champion of Great Britain. Joey got the Lonsdale belt. And Richie Lloyd. They were the four trainers.
And, I mean, we saw later on in your career in Superstars that you were an all-round athlete. And at the time, athletics and football were sort of both on the table. You could have perhaps gone into both of those, couldn't you?
Definitely, yeah. Football or I was a back, you know. I was left half. It was the best or the fastest as a forward, like going up. But it was usually a left back or left half. And left back in the dressing room a lot, but... But it was good. I liked it. It was like a blocker. You know, all you knew you had to do is just stop them. So that was good. That suited me. And then get the ball to somebody who's really fast. I remember that was in, it was one of the guys in the team. I played in a school called St. Kevin's, the senior school in Kirby. And in our team was Terry McDermott, a former Liverpool and Newcastle player, great player. And he was the guy. He's one of the guys, for example, you're trying to get the ball to. Because once he got it, you know, he was away like a greyhound. He was a fantastic footballer.
And people talk about, people still talk about your talent and say you were a natural talent when it came to boxing and how good you were technically. Were you good from the start? Did it come naturally to you?
Definitely. Yeah, I found it was natural. And the same with the, as you mentioned, the athletics and anything sporty, football, sport, didn't do cricket, rugby, didn't do it at school. But, well, he didn't have it at our school, yeah. But anything, sports, certainly athletics as well. So I think for once it was just the decision of making the decision of what which one I was going to go into. And it was the boxing. And I found was more natural to me, you know, maybe in about the, I was just going to say maybe in about the money there. But then again, the money wasn't there when you're an amateur. So more than that.
Yeah, of course. And then your amateur career took you all the way to gold medal, to a gold medal at the Commonwealth Games in 1970. Was that in Edinburgh, wasn't it?
Edinburgh, yeah, 1970 Games, middleweight. And yeah, it was with a great team. It was great being in the England team. And it was a fantastic time up there, you know. And I remember, I think Princess Anne was competing in there as well. Yeah, she was... just a great memories, you know, great athletes and sports people and boxers at the time.
But you didn't cash your chips in just then to turn pro. You actually went to the European Championships in Madrid in 71.
Yeah, I went to 71 in the European Championships, failed miserably there, you know, didn't have a good night at all. And I came back and also I won the... was that the middleweight? See, 70 was 71. No, 70 was the middleweight. Yeah, European Championship. And like as like I said, I came back and I thought, well, I was at a bit of a crossroads and I thought, could I have done better? You know, committed myself totally to it. And I said, yeah, I could have done better and I would have done better in those games if I did commit myself to it. So I learned from those mistakes and I sort of made a decision to go forward with the boxing.
Yeah, of course. You went to 11-0 and then fought as a professional and then fought Philadelphia's tough Eddie Duncan, who had a very short but tough career, really. He upset you at the Empire Pool in Wembley. What happened that night?
Yeah, it was just a bad night. You know, just sort of, he's not only a bad night, I found him a really good fighter. You know, I think he was just a bit above me in experience, I found. And he was just a tough lad, hard, but, you know, cagey. And he was just a very experienced. And he beat me on points. But again, coming back, learning from it, you think, well, what would you have done next time if you fought him again? And it would have been just a lot more positive.
It's great that you can look back and assess things like this because it shows fighters today that a loss isn't the end of the world, because quite often people talk about unbeaten records and how precious they are. But if you take a loss as a lesson in education, you can actually get a lot more out of it.
Well, definitely, yeah. You think about the greatest and where you're going. Talking about winning and losing, you on a in a business where, you know, you're winning, you want to win. It's a win thing. And so there's always levels. And so you're thinking, you're always trying to get records and all that. And you go higher and higher. And some people go higher than others. So you go to the likes of the Muhammad Ali's, you know, for example. They've done everything, transcended everything, done all those levels. And you're trying to get up there on those levels. You know, the most defences, the greatest fighter, all that. So they're targets and their ambitions you want to get to, you know. So they're the levels. And some go, like I said, like the likes of Muhammad Ali, go to the top level. So that's what I was trying to do.
When you fought Duncan, that was on the Chris Finnegan and Bob Foster bill. How highly did you rate Bob Foster?
He was a great fighter. Only his record speaks for that. And Chris done a great fight with him, pushed him right to the 14th. I think it was 14th or 15th round. And but he was, like I said, he was a great puncher. Bob, long, 6'3". Very tall, slim, and but great power puncher.
A few fights later, you boxed on the Ali Bugner bill along with John H. Stracey. You had visions of being a heavyweight, didn't you? But it was around about that time when Muhammad Ali said otherwise.
Well, look, I didn't really have them. It was George in the management, you know, my George Francis, they was just saying, they were billing me as a heavyweight. You think he's going to blow up to be a heavyweight? If there was cruiserweights around at the time, obviously I would have been cruiser. Would have been, it wasn't killing me to make light heavy, 12 and a half, but I would have made 13 and a half or 13.10 would have been suited me as well. But being a heavyweight, you know, no, I was never there, you know, wasn't big enough. You got to have the power. It's not just the size, that's the height. You got short heavyweights, Mike Tyson, different people like that, Marciano and that, and then you got tall, powerful heavyweights, but they've all got the same power. You got to have the power of the heavyweight division as well, which I didn't have. I could punch my own power, you know, light heavy or cruiserweight. And like I said, there was no cruiserweight. Light heavy was cruiser, which is 12 and a half stone maximum. So I never really thought it was a heavyweight. And then they just dropped me down when I came back from the Ali fight. Anyway, when I fought Teddy Daniels over there in Vegas, when Ali fought Joe Bugner, and then John was on the bill as well, John H. And we said it was building England versus America, and we beat them 2-1.
What was it like being around Ali? I've seen quite a lot of pictures of you with Ali over the years.
Well, it was great, you know, because he was just, remember I was in there when it was 1963. Was that when he when he beat Liston, yeah, for example, and even coming up then, it may have been as well, listening to on the radio, getting up early, my dad getting us up early, tuning in the radio to listen to the Muhammad Ali fight. So 62, I would be 12 then, you know. And and you're dreaming, you know, all these great fighters. You used to get the Ring magazine, Boxing News, Ring in particular, because it was international and American. And they would sort of inspire you, you know, reading, looking at these great fighters, and you're thinking, how did they do it? Fancy, you know, how would you do it against them? Because these are like giants type of thing, you know, really hard lads, that's professionals or whatever weight. So that was, it was inspirational. And certainly Muhammad Ali was. Next thing, you're on his bill and you're meeting him and you're fighting on his undercard, stuff like that. And you're up there as well. And you don't really see that transition, you know, from where you were to where you are, or you're getting there, because you're still driving. Like I said about titles and levels, you're still trying to get to there's always another challenge, you know, the greatest, the most defences, all that type, the most fights, all that, like the Muhammad Ali records.
Yeah, of course. What was Ali like as a person? Did you like being around him?
Yeah, it was great. It was just the way, again, inspirational for me. You know, I think the greatest fighter was Muhammad Ali. But I think it's because they say a great boxer will beat a great fighter 8 out of 10. Just stuff over the years, off the top of my head, these figures, like, you know. But why? Because a great boxer is a great fighter. You know, you can't just be a great boxer and beat the great fighters. Somewhere along the line on the title fight, they're going to get you right in front of them, and you've got to be able to punch your way out of there, you know, and you've got to have the power to punch and the aggression, all the rest of it, what they've got. But then if they're still there in front of you, you can move. You've got more tools in the bag, as Muhammad Ali's proved. You know, even again, like I said, 8 out of 10, the Joe Frazier, the first time round, they beat him in the Marcianos, and this, they're so sure they can beat you. But I'm talking about 8 out of 10, a great boxer would beat a great fighter. And that's why I think Muhammad Ali was the greatest. And his style, and I liked his style. Obviously, I was a box fighter, so it suited me as well. Ali appealed to me.
Sure. You came back, you stopped Rudiger Schmidtke for the European title. How big a night was that for you?
Well, that was a great night, you know. It's coming back, you know, from fights all the time. You're learning, as we said earlier. Any losses, any crossroads, you know, you come back and you think, well, if I'm going to continue, can I learn from this? Yes. And, you know, you move forward and you've got great people in your corner. George Francis was my manager. He was great, you know, great trainer and manager. And we'd learn and we'd go forward on it, you know. So the previous leading up to the European titles, I'd learned from him. And he was a great fighter as well. Rudy, he beat Chris Finnegan. And then I had to fight after he beat Chris. I boxed him, yeah. But that was one of my greatest nights at Wembley.
When you reached European level, did you think that you were world class? Did you know that you'd go on to win a world title then? Or did you think that that might be the ceiling?
Not really. I just took up one fight at a time. I know it's a bit of a saying, you know, and glib, possibly glib, saying one fight at a time, but it was true. You know, because I thought, well, I'm just going to give it everything I've got and see how far I go each fight. You know, it's the same in the ring. You trained up for it. You most fights are won and lost on the training ground, George said. So I used to prepare on the training ground for what I knew was going to happen in the ring as far as, you know, endurance and being pushed. And did you have the response? Yes. So the fellow in the other opposite corner couldn't go any further than you. You know, he may not go further than you, but he couldn't. You'd be able to keep up with him as far as the training's concerned and the response. That's all I trained for, you know, for that. And so I used to take a sort of one fight at a time and see how far I'd go. So whatever George was managing it, putting the fights in front of me, and then see how far I'd go. And the next thing, I won a world title.
Yeah, after winning the European, you fought Finnegan for the British, Commonwealth and European titles in a huge fight. How good was Chris?
He was great. You know, he's an Olympic silver medal. An Olympic gold medal. And 1968, I think it was. Just a great fighter, great champion, tough, hard, technically brilliant, yeah. And very awkward as a southpaw as well. You know, they're very difficult to fight southpaws. Certainly great ones, you know. They know how to use that stance. So that was very difficult. But I remember I was training with a great southpaw, Pat McCann. He was tough, hard, tall, built. I'd say 6'2", I think Pat was. 6'1", 6'2", I was 6'4". And so he brought me on, prepared me for Chris Finnegan, who was another southpaw. So that really helped with Pat McCann helping me, you know. And that was a great night. So on the 15 rounds I went.
What was your relationship like with Chris?
Okay, you know, fine, yeah. I used to see him at the different fights and different occasions, certainly during, certainly afterwards, anyway, after the game, after we retired, I used to see him a lot, you know, Libre, London Ex-Boxers Association, and there are these different charities, some fights and all that. And I try to, you know, be steady with most of the people I meet, you're trying to get on with.
Yeah, of course.
Well, outside the ring, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. When business is conducted, after business has been conducted, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was going to add, you know, that's what me barrister told me to say, anyway.
You fought Rondon, then you fought American Fred Lewis, who never fought again after fighting you, and outpointed the late Les Stevens, who recently passed away. What are your memories of Les?
No, it was a great night again, Les. Remember, I boxed Les when I was campaigning as they had me as a heavyweight. And I think it was at the Albert Hall with Les. I think so, yeah. The Albert Hall, we used to big venues. The Albert Hall and the Wembley Arena, we used to, it was the two main venues we boxed at. And I think I boxed Les at the Albert Hall in 73. And I was still, like I said, being billed as a heavyweight because Les was a heavyweight. And great fighter, Les, you know. But I was just faster because I was smaller as a lighter and sharper, quicker, and I boxed around. And he was very tough, Les, you know, great, could take a hammer blow, you know, you wouldn't have him over. You knew that, you knew he was going to go the distance. You go with some fighters in the ring, hit them with your best shot, and you're going to be there all night. So it's a punch situation you're going for. And Les was like that, you know. And also, but at the same time, if you let your guard down, they'd have you over.
Yeah, of course. Okay. You then had a couple more big wins over Tom Boggs and Finnegan again, and then fought for the title. Set the scene for us in terms of getting the shot.
Yeah, well, like again, all the previous fights were building me up and preparing me for it, and I knew I was ready for it because George said he was ready. He's ready. You believe that. I knew you were ready. You accepted it. You trained for it, as I did all the fights properly. And you're just looking forward to it, you know. I was going to take it one. I never thought we were going to knock, you know, like beat him inside the distance. If I'm not quite sure if anybody did beat Georgia Marley inside the distance. I'm not quite sure about that. I don't think they did. But so you knew he was a guy, you're going to be boxed, you're going to be there all night for the 15 rounds. So I had to be super duper fit, and he's going to be on you all the time as well. And that's where the training came in.
Were you the pre-fight favourite?
I think I was, yeah, because close maybe, because it was in my own background. my backyard. It was, I think it was a favourite.
And even just two fights before he came and fought you, he got a draw with Bob Foster. So it showed you how good he was.
Yeah. That's just what I'm saying. He was a great puncher, Bob, and didn't he? Must have hit him with some great shots, and he didn't turn George over. But, so that was 15 rounds and 15 grueling hard rounds, and I reckon that was my greatest night.
What was it like to be called a world champion? How did things change overnight?
It was like a dream, you know, because only 3 years earlier, I was in Liverpool, just considering whether to turn pro or not, and whether I could, and even as an amateur, I used to train with professionals. You know, Harry Scott from Bootle, former middleweight contender, great fighter from Bootle, hard guy, fought all these great fighters, Bob Parry's box. And I used to go down to Billy McDonald's gym in Liverpool. I was in Kirby, about 14 miles north of Liverpool. And I used to take the bus down to the gymnasium and spar with Harry. Now he was a pro. And you think, God, fancy going 15 rounds with these guys, he'd never be able to do it, because it was tough enough going three rounds with them, sparring, you know, three, four rounds with them in the gym there. But you thought, just give it everything. You know, once you, if they can do it, you can do it. And so coming back to the question, I think about on the night, the fight, and right back from what I said about amateur, sparring pros, next thing, you got Harry Gibbs has lifted my hand up in the ring after 15 rounds at the Wembley in 1974. It was like a dream because of those previous years and what I was just talking about. I think, well, that was it. Just sort of taking it one fight at a time, totally committing myself to the business once I at those crossroads, you know. If I was going to go forward, I was going to totally commit myself to it, give it everything I've got. And, great line in my head was, for me personally, was God helps them who helps themselves, you know. So that worked for me when I was an amateur and as a kid at those crossroads. I thought, well, I'd come back and I thought, well, did I help myself? Well, yes. Well, totally no. Well, there you go. So it was down to you. So I helped myself 100% in my head what I was saying. He'll help me. And that's what happened. Like I said, 3 years later, once I turned pro, Harry Gibbs was raising my hand after 15 rounds of winning the title.
How did things change in terms of your lifestyle and becoming famous? Because fame obviously follows the world title. So did your life change?
Yeah, I was much more famous than when I was in Kirby. Outside, I was thinking about enjoying yourself, you know, outside celebration. There seems to be bigger celebrations. But when I was in Kirby was good.
But better.
But like London was just better, bigger and better. But yeah, it was just fantastic, you know. I enjoyed it. It was just a buzz, very high. You're getting, everything's going great, you know. You're working, you're winning, you're enjoying it, you're enjoying outside the ring, you know. You're meeting all these great sorts of famous people, let's say, and you're involved in going to great restaurants and, you know, do's or whatever, meeting people. And it was just exciting stuff, very high, heady stuff.
Yeah, of course. You defended against Lonnie Bennett when he and you won by a cut. What caused the cut?
Maybe an accidental clash of heads as well, you know. That used to happen.
Yeah, did you ever get accused of being free with your head? Because there were a couple of fights that wound up with head clashes.
Yeah, I was accused of it, yeah. But George always said, always keep your head in a position that if there's an accidental clash of heads, you know, you wouldn't come off second best.
Sounds like good advice.
Well, he's a good lawyer. cost me a lot of money.
So is it true that you broke your hand against Willie Taylor because George wasn't there to wrap your hands?
Yeah, definitely. I broke up with George after the first defence. And then I signed up with Don King. And I had a fight at Scranton, Pennsylvania in 1975 against Willie Taylor. And I broke my hand. Richard Giacchetti, who was Larry Holmes' trainer, Rich tied my hand, you know, and he'd done well. He's a good man. But he George had a special way of doing them, tying them. And I remember breaking my hand, I think, in the third round with a right cross, a right sort of right hook, right cross. And went back to my corner and I said to Richie, I remember, I said, I could feel it gone, you know. I said, Richie, I said, my right hand's broke, you know. And he said, use your left. So I thought, God, I could be doing this job. That's all you got to do, just tell them to do that. But which I did, and I won on points. Well, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was a 10-rounder or an 8-rounder. I think it was a 10-rounder. But this was like the fourth round, third or fourth round, I broke it. So I just jabbed. And it was, you know, if it was maybe a higher fight, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
How hard was the split with George?
Yeah, it was very tough, you know. It was, but you couldn't show them at the time when these things are happening. You don't sort of confront them consciously in front of you. You'd say, and assess them. Yeah, this is, because I believe if I could have done that, I would have done that. I wouldn't have split them, because I would have done that before the split. Would have assessed all that and brought it out. But you're just driving as a kid. You just drive and drive and drive. And you, so whatever you see it, you call it as you see it straight away and you act on it. And that was a tough split, yeah, because you knew it was the wrong thing.
Tell me about, is it Highgate Pond where I've seen pictures of you?
Yeah. I used to train over there, run over the Hampstead Heath, but we used to start off at the ponds, change at the ponds, Highgate Ponds, and then run out to the ponds and all over the heath and end up back in the ponds, come back, exercises, few weights, and then we used to run out and jump into the pool, the pond there. And all through the winter, sometimes break the ice through the winter just to have a dip as an exercise. George was, it was his, part of his regimen, yeah. And yeah, we done it. It was great, just discipline, really. And it was in the men's enclosure.
There's a picture of you starkers doing about to jump in the pond. Yeah. Who were you with in that picture?
Yeah, Bunny Stalin and Bunny Johnson. So Bunny, both their British and European champions, I think. And certainly, I think Bunny Johnson, I think, was European champion as well as British champion. And Bunny Stalin was middleweight champion in Great Britain and boxed for the, I think he boxed for the world title.
How much of a shock was it a few years later when you heard that George had passed away?
Yeah, it was. Went to his funeral. And, yeah, it was very sad. Because, yeah, it's tough life, you know, George. Tough man, hard, Camden Town, he lived. He had a tough upbringing and became a great man, trainer and manager, you know, in the business of boxing. And brought his family up. And then it was tough. Then he had his young son, Simon, who I knew. He passed away first. His wife, Joan, great. She was terrific, Joan, who I met when I first came down. I stayed in their house when I first came down in 71, the first couple of weeks until they got me at a flat in Muswell Hill. And then I got a flat in Highgate then. But Joan was there, and Simon, a young lad, and he also had two, what a big, well, and his daughter, and two big lads, you know. Billy, sadly, just passed away recently, last couple of weeks. Billy Francis, they were both in the music business, Billy and Danny. Danny used to looked after John Bon Jovi. And Danny was with Sting since the early 1970s. He's been with them, you know, as the road manager. And he passed away, Billy, a couple of weeks ago. Got through that. Like I said, George himself went, Joan and Simon went. And then... he went to
George.
So, yeah, it was a tragedy.
Had you made amends with George?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, it'd be pretty... That was around about... we done it right from when we got back together, you know, 76, I think it was. And, yeah, and also after that as well.
Yeah.
In the late 80s.
Did you identify, obviously, you mentioned the death of his son and his wife, but obviously that led to him and his depression, or was a trigger. Is depression something that you've ever experienced and gone through?
Well, yeah, I think it's a human condition, isn't it? It's all part of the human condition. I think the depression and just affects some people in a medically deeper way. A problem, you know, they've got an actual, like an illness. It's an illness, so, you know, can become an illness with the depression. But like I said, I've got, it's a human condition. I've got all these emotions and all that. It's, but I can deal with them.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
No, it's not to say that those don't deal with them. It's in a way, it's they have a different way of dealing with them.
I get what you're saying. Some people process it and handle it differently, for sure. I get that.
And can do, because they're not afflicted with the depth of the illness.
Yeah, of course. Okay. You fought tough Yaki Lopez in Denmark. He's actually been on this podcast. I know Yaki quite well. I've seen him a couple of times, been over to his home in Stockton.
Yeah.
What did you make of Yaki, who was known to be one of the best guys to never win a world title?
Yeah, he was a great fighter. Tough, again, you know, going to go all the way. You knew when you go in there, you hit him at your best shot. He wasn't going to go. Tough as nails. Hard, very experienced, fought all the great fighters. So it was just sort of, you know, an honour to be in the ring there and to win, to be a winner. I think it was a Copenhagen.
That's right.
We boxed. Yeah.
He said he was sent round the houses to get you. I think he said it took him about 4 days to fly from Los Angeles to Denmark. And I think he thought Mickey Duff was playing tricks on him with his transportation and away fighting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And he's probably right there with that. And, like I say, I took the fight. It was just a fight. So how Yaki got there, how I got there, I made my way there, you know, and the business side of it, well, yeah, these, you can go into that, how it's managed and formed, you know, with the bit on the business side of it, on the promoters, the managers, different ring altogether, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. Okay. You got wins over Len Hutchins and then Joe Coakes. Then you went to Belgrade to take on Mate Parlov, who'd drawn and lost to Matthew Franklin, as he was then. Parlov was an Olympian. What was Belgrade like? It's not your average boxing destination. 40,000 fans, I believe, there that night.
Yeah. It was a great night. And it was one of my best nights, really. I thought I won the fight. And they tell me, I went down the Danube on a party afterwards, after the 15 rounds. It was a close decision. I thought I well won it. And I think I definitely would have got it over there. But we went down for the party down the Danube. And Marte, he went to his hospital, you know, to sort the injuries out. Sounds like I'm not being flashed here. I'm just, that's a fact. It's a bit scouse humor there, but it's true as well. But I don't mean it in a real, you know, having a pop on anyone, but that was a fact. But I did well. I felt a well won the fight, you know. And but don't take nothing away from him. Great champion, Olympic champion, won the world title and all.
What was it like in Belgrade? How long did you spend there? I'm guessing not too.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. It was terrific, you know. I thought it was a lot of. I thought it was scousers. I could understand them, but they could understand me. They thought I was, I think, a Croat or whatever. Same. I don't know. into deeper waters here. But it was just a great night. We had all the Liverpool lads. My family was there. Great support. And it was fantastic. It was like boxing in Liverpool, really. Or a Wembley, you know, because they were all behind you. A lot of people came over. And we all then we had a great time. And like I said, we had done a good fight, 15 rounds, and didn't get the decision.
It's great you can look back on it so with you know, so lightheartedly. But at the time, you must have been heartbroken or felt aggrieved to have been robbed. It was, you know, people remember it as a bad decision.
Well, yeah, but not too deep. I mean, it's the way it goes, like, you know, and. I think you said, what did you say? Did you say lighthearted?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe it's got something to do with, I'm a Gemini as well.
Okay.
I said, no, I'm not. Yes, I am. Well, maybe. I used to be indecisive, but now I'm not quite sure. No, another way is, I think, to put it into balance type of thing, you know, to look at it and just say, well, give it the best I could. Give it the best shot I could. And it's a bit like that. Looking deeper into it about repression and like, denying certain things and all the rest of it. Well, maybe. And maybe it's good to repress and deny. Well, you got to sort it out yourself. But the fact is, what happened, and you gave the best I could to win. I wasn't in there trying to lose.
Did you feel that? You did feel that was the best you could have done. You couldn't have done any more to get a decision over there.
No, not on the night. Done the best I could. You can only do the best you can, yeah. And sometimes it's, you know, sometimes better than others.
You got two wins either side of a draw with tough Jesse Burnett, who I think fought Yaki Lopez multiple times. What was Burnett like?
Yeah, it was I remember styles as well, you know. Some styles suit different people. So a guy could give another guy a real tough fight. But to you, he doesn't give you such a tough fight because of his style suits you. Whereas the other guy didn't suit his style, like, you know. Didn't suit, and vice versa. And I had a couple of people like that, you know, and who I thought gave me problems, let's say, but didn't give other fighters problems. Jesse was a great fighter.
He put you down, I think, in the first and the eighth of a 10 rounder. I think Boxing News said that you were. I think basically shoe on the other foot this time, said that you got the hometown decision to get a draw with Burnett. Is that fair?
Which town was it in?
Hometown. London. It was a dinner show in London.
Oh, well, then I'll definitely get it in. I should think so. Well, I was paying for the dinner. Yeah, I suppose a close decision and all that, like I said. Yeah. And I feel you win to win, and vice versa. Like you say, you go, you think you win somewhere, and they give it to the other guy.
Then came the two historic fights with Matthew Saad Muhammad. The first one was an absolute epic, remembered as one of the best ever at 175 pounds. What are your memories of that night in Atlantic City?
Oh, it was great, you know, because he was a real tough fighter. You're trying to draw back the years in a way, for me anyway, even though I was only 29, 28 maybe even, because 29 I retired the next year. But you're trying to draw. And it's just, you know, you're drawing from the past, doing what you did when you were a kid. But I felt, you know, it was harder. He wasn't there as much as when you're younger. And for me at that time, but I give it, it was a great night. It went 15 rounds. Again, giving the best you can, you think, well, that's it. That's the best I could get.
How good was Matthew? What did he do well as a fighter?
Well, he beat me. And as far as I'm concerned, he obviously was a great fighter, wasn't he? I mean, I don't look at it as close. You guys would be looking at it closer. Some boxers do. Like Mike Tyson's a great viewer of the fights. He knows about the fights. He reads them, the history and all the rest of it. Like, yeah. I'm not. I don't think most of us are. But I mean, it's a bit like football, I always say. Football managers do a lot of great players become managers. And they don't. They tell me the footballers. I play with a lot of footballers with the charity golf, you know. And they say they don't know a lot of great footballers. So really tough. Footballers don't become managers. I've lost the thread I was going to say. I went into football.
Yeah, no, you were saying about I was asking you to analyse what Matthew did well as a fighter.
Yeah, me viewing it. That was the idea. Yeah? Whether it's journalists or people or fans, you know, can view it much better than some boxers. Like I said, Mike Tyson can view it and talk about it. Yeah, what did he do? You just knew he was a great fighter, a puncher. Could take a shot, boxer, experienced, all that. It's a bit like going into the fight. Me answering this is a bit like Joe going to the fight with George Francis. And George used to tell you just general stuff. He didn't go into intricate stuff, what he knows about the fighter or whatever. He'd just say, well, he's got this, he's, you know, and you knew that anyway, you watch him. Generally, you're just looking at general, what does he do? Does he box? Is he a pure boxer? Is he a box fighter? Can he punch? Is he short? Is his southpaw orthodox? Is he short? Is he squat? Is he a body worker? You know? And all them just go in just like that. There's six, half a dozen even little points go into your head, and that's it. You don't analyze them and all that. You just got it. That's it. And you're thinking about your response to it, to whatever they've got, you know, as opposed to what, no matter how good what he has got, you're thinking about how to counteractor anyway, so you got to focus on your own stuff. But that's in relation to you and these. You mentioned Matthew, how great he, how in which he had all these great things, and why and how. Like I said, you, for me personally, was just fighting them. Yeah, and you guys can speak out. I know he's a great fighter. Exactly, technically, why you people can do that.
You ran up a big lead against him and cut him open, and obviously this was the main talking point post-fight, was the wounds that you'd inflicted on his above his eyebrows, terrible cuts that were glued shut by Adolf Ratako, his cut man, who was subsequently banned. Did you think that during the fight that was unusual, the stuff that was on his face to close the cuts? Were you aware that something was up and there might have been some skullduggery in the corner?
Not really. I just didn't bother me, you know. I just let them do what they want to do. And George, if there's any, George would take care of that. If there's anything out there or the people around the ring, the officials, whatever, subconsciously. I'm not trying to be cleverly saying this, but that's simply the way I used to go into the fight. I used to just focus on what I had to do. And what he was doing, what he was doing, and whether he should have been doing or should do it, or can do it or can't do it. And that's down to the authorities or the George in my corner. Sort of like, you know, and it's a bit like noticing the splinter in your brother's eye and you don't see the log in your own. Talking about eyes. So it wasn't for me to view what he was doing there wrong in his corner, you know. He's doing some wrong things myself.
With regards to that, I mean, how much did it get to you afterwards, the fact that it was revealed that how there had been foul play, the fact that they had not done things by the book? Did it upset you?
Not so. No. Good. In the sense of, again, that's the judgment of the authorities, you know?
Yeah.
He's in there, it's like whatever keeps you up. It's like, I don't know, I'm not a soldier and all that, but it must be like war or something, you know. So if you're up still there alive, you know, they're keeping you up there doing the job. That's it. The idea is to win, you know.
But you would have been
or not lose. And so that was down to that. I respected them for that, you know, to do that in a way. Terrific. And the authorities, obviously, I wouldn't vote or not vote for it. It's just the way it is. Just the rules are made up by the authorities, aren't they?
How much did that night of the first fight take out of you emotionally and psychologically and physically, that 15-round fight?
Well, it was the party afterwards, really.
Drained the life out of you.
It wasn't the fights. They were easy. But it was the party, and afterwards took it out of me, I bet. But then again, that's what I was in there for. When I was a kid, holy hell, they thought, God, what do? You get the money and you can have a good time. Yeah, great, do it. They were telling you to do that. You do it, you win the title, you start doing it. He said, what are you doing? So, well, you said, I could do this once I got here. He said, we didn't think you were going to make it, number one. Number two, we didn't think you were going to do it that much.
What were the main differences, apart from the obvious, between the first fight and the second fight? What went wrong for you in the second fight?
Certainly wasn't any. Preparation was doing all the same training, and again, as I said earlier, I just felt that mental reaction wasn't there, or the physical, even, you know, the physical. I think it was sort of the lifestyle must have been taking its toll as well outside the ring, and so you're still doing the same training and preparation, But that's certainly not as a young, like when you're young, just there, the hunger and the response, you know, the machine is there, you know, and you can do anything, tell it to do anything, it'll do it and more. And that was sort of not there. The mental side was still there, you know, doing it technically, doing the same stuff, but there wasn't the same response.
Yeah. So you're talking about kind of desire that's inbuilt rather than actually physically going through the motions and doing everything that you need to do training wise. It's like a desire.
Both. Ambition. Well, both. Both. I feel me. Because remember, they said, because the lifestyle outside the ring, I think, is Satan's toll as well. And so it's physical and mental. You know, and then and levels. Everyone's got different levels of how to deal with it. Some could even go beyond that, even in the same position, but could go further. And then some don't have those problems, maybe outside the ring, like Muhammad Ali was never like that. You know, he didn't drink, smoke, drugs, or anything like that. I was partying, he was he was a bit boring, really. But
first time I've ever heard anyone call Ali boring.
Scouse. No, not Ali. I'm just saying scousely humour there. About the other stuff, my stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, there.
There was one more fight back in Liverpool.
What's the point again?
There was one more fight back in Liverpool against James Dixon, and then that was that. Why did you retire? You'd lost that hunger.
Yeah, the hunger. Lost it, and the desire wasn't there. And I knew if I was going to go in there, continue fighting, you're going to take more shots. Yeah, than you did previously and all that. And you're going to take more than what you're given, I'd say, or at least a lot more than what you had been taken in the past. So I thought, no, the sensible thing was say that was it. And it was either all or nothing for me type of thing.
Was it hard to admit to that it was no longer there? Was it hard because so many people struggle to leave boxing behind?
No, it was quite simple for me in a way. I think subconsciously it may have been. You know, because the fear, the anxiety, where you're going to go now, you expose you in a bigger public situation, an awareness thing, you know. You're more exposed than if it was just, you know, anonymous everything going further back when you're a kid or whatever it is, or younger. Or not making it, now you're exposed. And then, so what do you do? And you're going in, what business are you going to go into as well? So you're not mentally prepared for all that. But you don't talk about that, you don't dialogue that, you don't see that, or want to see it, whether you do or you don't. You don't. And so it's not a case of these emotions and feelings and thoughts and realities of life. Seeing them, stepping back with the maybe significant other people to sit down around the table and discuss a plan, identify the weaknesses, the ways, like a business or whatever. You know, what's the problem? How do we attack it? You don't do that because you're not brought up that way. You thought my mind was, you're brought up just punching your way out or kicking your way out as a footballer, sports, music. No disrespect to all the sports players, footballers or musicians, because everyone's different, handles it, no matter how much money they get and how what positions they're all. Like some fighters can go greater and greater and greater, whatever. You can be with problems out the ring as well. And same in all these other businesses, you know. So musicians and footballers, everyone's different how they handle it. And but like I said, sitting down, you look back now, and that's what obviously you would advise someone to do. Or you do it yourself. It's a bit like thinking of, why am I thinking of Morgan Freeman? In Shawshank,
okay.
When he's in front of the parole board.
Yeah.
When they're asking them, they're saying, well, what would you do? What's changed? Or what would you do different now? You know? And he's looking back and he's just being honest. And he's saying, well, he'd tell that kid, you know, he said, they'd direct them a different way.
Yeah, of course. There was nearly a comeback, wasn't there? Weren't you working with Dennis Andreese at the Beckett for a while?
Yeah, Dennis. Yeah, I've seen Dennis. We've done a bit of sparring at the not the Beckett. I think it was at the Wellington. I think Dennis was at the Beckett. I think he trained over there. But I think we had a little spar maybe at the Wellington over in North London, in just down the road by in Highgate there. And yeah, I was thinking about playing to come back again. I couldn't believe it because I was, like I said, all or nothing. And here's me half thinking I'm going to make a comeback. I just couldn't really believe it, you know, to myself. I was just thinking, well, hang on a minute. It's like, come back where? Where are you coming back to? You can't go back. You come back to go back, you know, to where you were. And where you were, you have those, didn't have those problems, anxieties. You're just young, strong, hungry, made the decision forward. Now you're trying to go back there to regain the old ground. I thought, well, for me, no. Couldn't be done. So I made the decision, but I couldn't believe how easy lads do go back. And that's not the right decision for a lot of them. And they get into worse situations, let's say, either physically or not. But so I was good at making that decision, but I could understand how easy that you could get sucked in.
So were you content with your boxing career when you retired? Did you think that you'd fulfilled your potential and done all that you could have done?
No. I didn't feel that, and I don't feel that now.
Did it frustrate you? Does it still frustrate you?
Yes. All those things, they're all there. But as we just said earlier, getting around the table almost and dialoguing them, saying, well, what are we talking about? What's the analysis of it all, you know? You know, I've done better than a lot of guys maybe coming into the game, not as good as some. And so putting it into that context, and then what is it, where is it you? And this is not like trying to deny things or anything like that. I was looking at them, the good and the bad. You know, and that's it. And then also what's behind it? What's behind the desire? What's the anxiety anyway? Based on ambition, drive, getting to the top. You know, well, we're all at the top, taking a breath one day at a time, and call that self-justification to suit me arguments, whether it's not an LB, it's not an argument, it's a statement, it's a fact of life, you know, one breath at a time. We're here. This is the top here. So that's, you know, put it to context that way. And then all the games and the jobs are still there as well. And whatever game you're in, I've got my own different stuff, still trying to, you know, compete, let's say. But it's with an awareness, you know, it's where I am as here now. I try to keep my head where my body is nowadays.
You've referred a couple of times to parties and that lifestyle that you were, that was sort of permanently snapping at your heels. How big of an issue was drink at the time? Was it? Did it become all-consuming?
If it was a full bottle, I consumed it all.
Really? Yeah.
It was all-consuming. Yeah. One was too many. 100 wasn't enough. I got to a point. I'm an alcoholic, you know. So I got to alcoholism. And so I got to a point where one drink was too many, 100 wasn't enough. And because you cross the line, a physical allergy in the body, you don't metabolize it 1 ounce an hour. It stays in there longer than 1 ounce an hour, physically craves another one. They say this would be academic if you didn't take the first thing that's going to trigger up the allergy. Hay fever sufferers don't have an obsession to sniff flowers, you know, but they haven't got the insane urge, the obsession, the double-edged sword, to take the first thing that's going to trigger off the allergy. The problem centers in the mind. So the obsession in the mind. So I was being treated for alcoholism in early 80s, you know, in a clinic in London for alcoholism.
So you're teetotal now and have been for years?
Yeah, I haven't had a drink one day at a time for 31 years.
When was the last time you had an urge?
Very rarely. Yeah. Very rarely, because when you say an urge, when you even the word teetotal, it's not even a case of teetotal. Some people have a choice. They can be teetotal and have a drink and be normal drinkers, let's say, or decide to be teetotal. You know, I'm an alcoholic, you know. So if I have one drink, I can't stop.
Yeah.
Because of the allergy of the body, you know. And I wouldn't go back to where I stopped when I was 31 years ago, because the aging process would be worse again. You know, take a drink now. But the problem is, was the obsession of the night. But I went to an outfit who sorted out most successful outfit in dealing with alcoholism. There's other ways of dealing with it, but this particularly company group, they have the most success rate dealing with it, and that sorted me out.
Right. What's the biggest John Conti myth?
When you say myth, what do you mean? I was trying to think of a scouse. I now think of Mr. Train.
What do you think people think about you that's not true? Let's go with that. What do you think? Do you think people know who you are? Do you think people know who the real John Conti is?
I don't know. I don't really know today when I think about it. I mean, obviously, because all ego and awarenesses. Why would I be worried? Or why they think that I'm in? Why would I be worried if they are anyway? Well, because I'm human. It's normal. Anyway, right. So what? Yeah, but is that the agenda for me today? No. It's not my business is not to worry about to an extent where it's doing me, and on the opposite as well, worrying about my own stuff, working on my own stuff to a point where gets you into a frazzle, you know? And you're still alive and it's got you into a frazzle and you've got an option to get out. So I have. And deal with it, yeah. Dealing with life on life's terms.
Two questions that are sort of interlinked.
Can I just come back? Yeah. Can I just come back there? So did I answer your question? Your question was how people thought of me, or what do I think people and why and how?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't really matter. It's a bit. You think all the things to answer that question about why they would be thinking, why you'd be wouldn't all that, this, that, and the other, it's all normal, you know. But it's a bit, I tend to just hand over, you know, sort of let go. It's only about the worrying about what they're doing or thinking about me or I'm thinking about them, whatever it is. Like I said, it's causing you a problem. You can always stop and sort of let it go. Why am I thinking about it anyway? What's the root? Is the motive for it? What's the motive for it? Is it going to do somebody good? Is it going to do me any good? No. I'm just also thinking, let's say, well, I'm not making myself emotionally well, let's say, so. But I've got a choice. So I'm it over, let it go. Do think of something better.
In a world of social media and that kind of stuff, that's an area of contentment that not many people manage to find, where people do take criticism to heart and all the rest of it. So to have that peace of mind that you've got is a very powerful thing.
I take all these things to heart. I do all this, the normal stuff, but I don't take them to heart, or I middle take them, or I do take them, or go through all the normal human emotions, you know? But the point is like, yeah, well, I'm responsible for that. I'm the CEO of the company, the limited company. You know, John Conti Limited, isn't it? It's my life. What am I doing with it? So, you know, what am I selling here? Well, peace of mind. Okay, well, if I'm creating a disturbance or allowing that disturbance, which is like selling the wrong product, you know.
Yeah.
I just stand back and say, well, hang on, hold on.
No, that makes sense. So there's two questions now that are kind of linked. Very much from a fan perspective. Who didn't you fight that you would like to have fought, and who do you rate, or how do you rate the top five from that era of light heavyweights that you were amongst?
They were all great fighters. Bob Foster, Victor Galindez, that was it, I think.
Really. Marvin Johnson, Eddie Mustafa.
Yeah, those lads, all them, yeah, loads of them, you know, and you go back and you think, well, it's a bit like George, you know, lining the fights up when you first turn pro, and you're just going forward, bang, 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 bang. And you go back and you think, well, that's what I do at that level as well, you know, at the higher level, do the same thing, just go as a lot of lads do anyway. And there you go, bang, 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 bang. But, And that, so I do that. Not don't let that worry me, you know, because I tried to balance that out with what I did do,
sure.
Which was good. And there were a lot of lads. I'd done a lot, but like I said earlier, I got higher than some of the guys and not as high as some of the others. Yeah, all those lads you've mentioned there, they're all great fighters. Bob Foster, you said top five. Bob Foster, Victor Galindez, Saeed Mohammed. There was three. Chris Finnegan.
Michael Smith coming through. There's Dwight Cowie.
Yeah, all those, yeah. Deanna McMeg, Dwight, and yeah.
What if you could have done one thing differently, what would it be?
One thing differently. Well, there's more than one.
That's fair.
About 10 at least jumped into my head there straight away. I was going way back to Lockerbie, where I'm from. I was born in Toxteth. I left when I was four, so little memory of that. But it was Kirby, and I was thinking, jump me right back there. I think 10 things jumped in my head right away to say I'd do differently. It's picked them. What do you want to do? All kinds of different things. I wanted to be a musician. But I couldn't sing and I couldn't play any instruments.
It's a bad start.
But yeah, exactly. But I was trying. To break through, you know, when I was on the building site, I was a lad carrier, and he used to come on when I was taking music lessons, you know, piano lessons, trying to break through, so I didn't have to go through the boxing, you know, because the boxing was tough, but I couldn't break through Chopin, you know, to get through to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was something to do with the mortar on my hands, all this mud, this cement was dropping on the fellow's piano.
But how good's that, though? I mean, you talk about hog carrying and you wind up with an MBE in 2017. I mean, how much did that mean to you?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's brilliant. So I couldn't believe it, you know, and all the people that put me up for that. It was fantastic what they done. All the great guys and girls who put my name forward anyway. From Liebherr, London Xboxers Association, people involved in that. And Dave Harris was another one for the Hall of Fame, the British Boxing Ball Hall of Fame. Dave Harris was a great guy who put me up for it. There's a lot of people involved in that. And that was just a wonderful, fantastic thing. And to go to Windsor Castle and the Queen presented me with it was just fantastic, you know, brilliant. You go there, there's about 40 people there, I think, seemed to be in the room getting presented that day. And we didn't, from across, you know, all different businesses they're in. And obviously some of them, two in particular, were soldiers. two of them, I think, were Gurkhas. They were getting presented, you know. And they didn't look like Gurkhas, actually, because they didn't. You imagine them in the, you know, flak jackets and all that, you know. These are very sharp and like a black suits and gold braid or something, very sharp. And that's one of those long swords, you know, wasn't it? One of the other swords. But they were just very sharp. And then all kinds of other lads, and there's a lad from, and from all different charities and different people doing things for the society. And we didn't know, was the Queen going to be presenting it? Because she was out the day before she was launching the ship, the new Queen Elizabeth. The day before, so we didn't think it was going to be the Queen presenting it, because you don't know. It wasn't until half an hour before we knew it was the Queen presenting the medals. Like, you know. And I got that from a guy who was working in the household, and he was getting presented, and he said, isn't it great that the Queen's going to be doing it as well? And we didn't know until half an hour before. So, you know, coming from, you know, I was very proud, you know, my dad. My dad was from West Africa, Sierra Leone, Freetown, welder, come over 1943, the merchant seaman. My mother, 10 kids, Liverpool, Toxteth, Kirby, amateur boxing club. Next thing, you're in front of the Queen getting a medal.
Just as well you didn't get your head round Chopin then, because you might never have made it.
Well, that's one of the thing is I don't need to now. Because no one could know that in the sense of I listen to it. That's their game, isn't it? That's them. This is the funny thing, the fantastic talents, all these great talents, you know. And yet some of the greatest talents, you know, obviously you see them tragedies, you know, tragic as well. Music, musicians, say in particular, that's for me. And you think then, and then you're behind that, the analysis, the desire, well, why did you want to do it anyway? Other than just normal. Well, a lot of it's sort of crazy, you know. Ego, really, in a way, over the top ego. That's normal. Ego's normal. It's what you're doing with it, or how you're allowing it to control you. I think we've all got the one talent, the human life, and it's how you're dealing with that. And that's not a preaching thing. I'm just saying my own experience, my own, how I try to deal with it. It's like this interview now. I'm thinking, well, this hasn't gone very well. You know, because I've bobbed and, well, in the sense of I've bobbed and weaved and ducked and dived, and you've been avoided this or laughed at it, and you're judging yourself, beating yourself up that way, like, you know, and you think, well, hand it over, done the best I can, hand it over. And I know I'm talking to people, you, Tris, and number one, but goes out to whatever people there, the human race, they know it, they know. So they know what I'm saying, yeah.
I think people enjoy this, John, I do. I do have some listener questions as well. If we could go through some of these rapid fire, I'd appreciate that if you could answer some of these questions that are coming from some listeners.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so David Friend asks, I'd like to hear your top five British all-time list. So rather than put you on the spot, just who do you think's in the conversation?
Randolph Turpin beating the great Sugar Ray Robinson, yeah. Fantastic, brilliant. What he done. Sir Henry Cooper, not just for the boxing, for Henry, Sir Henry, but because he got me into the golf as well. Well, he didn't actually get, but Jimmy Tarbuck were playing. I didn't think I was going to, I thought, well, I didn't fancy him, but I thought they're playing, ignore that in my mind and just go because they'd done it. And I did, and that was about 83, 84. I got into the Variety Club, Golf Society, through them. So, yes, Sir Henry, great fighter. And obviously, to knock down Muhammad Ali, that great punch. And he's the only one that's standing in his way from winning a world title. So, I mentioned two there, yeah. Terry Downs winning the title, obviously, abroad as well. I think it was over here. Both, maybe one over there and one over there. Yeah, great fighters. Ken Buchanan.
Yeah.
Ken, fight winning a title abroad. Lennox Lewis. Lewis, great fighter, Lennox.
Okay.
Heavyweight.
I like this question from Buzz. I'm not sure you'll be able to answer this one. Best night out ever?
Best night out ever. When I won the world title, really, as far as the boxers concerned, you know, winning the world title on that night, because I was in the Playboy Club, went down to the Playboy, we got a little party down the Playboy Club afterwards, it was fantastic, you know, and then George took me out of there pretty quick to get me, took me down to a sauna place down on Jermyn Street in the West End there. Because to take the bruises out of the eyes and all that. Now, I didn't want to leave the Playboy Club, but he got me down there and got the ice on my eyes and all that, taking the bruises out. And then in the same street, almost opposite where we were, the sauna was Tramp, the club Tramp, you know, the nightclub, which I used to be going there. This was 74, so I'd started going there since 73, let's say. And Johnny Gold came over with a bottle of Dom Perignon to celebrate the win, so that was funny. That was good.
That was a good night. Yeah,
that was a great night. Yeah, that was, and also because of winning the title, and I was back there with my family, with in the ball beer bin. I was in the Playboy Club and all that, all the family and friends and George and all. So that was just a fantastic night that you'd won, and it was great for everyone. We had a buzz, and that was on the sports side, on the boxing side of it. Yeah, on the other side of the family, grandchildren, children being born, all that stuff. You know. My wife, married, you know, done many, many different things.
I like this question from Abed Ali, who says, please ask him his thoughts on James Scott and the Raw Way boxing fights. James Scott, in fact, I just looked through an old Boxing News yesterday, and he actually wrote to Boxing News calling you out one issue.
Well, I would have done if it was in Walton Jail in Liverpool. I would have done. where was he?
He was in Rahway.
Yeah. Where was that? New York?
New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey. Yeah. Well, what about, so what do you want me to say?
What was your take on James Scott? You know, what was your take on James Scott?
Well, can't really say, because he was in the big league, wasn't he? He was in Rahway prison. I only got to approved school.
Okay. So Tony Tyrus says, what strategy would you have used if you were to challenge Bob Foster had you not vacated the light heavyweight title?
Just speed, fast, to have to close, you know, to get in range with him, 6'3", you have to be in range and keep moving. So, you know, closer, the better would have been. Long shots for him would punch you long, straight punch, power punches he'd be looking for. I'd be getting in using my leverage, my length, but it was shorter than his type of thing, but I'd be using him to get in, just bobbing weavers, just boxed the way I did. Yeah. Box was a box fighter, you know, be very speed, movement, the you know, side to side movement, getting in, body, hooks, jabs, crosses, bearing in mind, but just points, thinking of punch decision, if a stoppage came in between any AMTO, not just with Bob Foster, I'm talking any fighters, if it came, great, the stoppage, but in the meantime, be busy and make sure that if it goes to the bell, you'll be win on punch, because a culmination of punches.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Two more. Jay Harris PT asks, what do you think of Tony Bellew and the legacy he's left in Liverpool?
Yeah, Tony was great, you know, he's come to fight. Great fighter from Liverpool, tough, hard lad, won the championship title, inspired a lot of other young lads as well to come along in the business, as it's adding to the business, but inspiring young fighters from Liverpool in particular to come along. And he was just a great fighter, you know.
Babs asks, in light of the recent happenings around the world, it would be good to get your first person experience on being a black British world champion and whatever hardships you endured during your pro career.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's the human condition. That's the way I look at it. And metaphor of the ring, being in the ring, you know, it's funny to call it a ring. We know it's a square. Don't tell them that, because they'll have an answer for that, you know, because I think historically it probably was a ring. They used to draw a ring, didn't they, just in the ground, the mud or whatever it is, and bare knuckle fighting type of thing. They called it the ring. Yeah, human condition. Like I said,
Was it hard? Did you come up against some adversity on racial grounds during back in those days?
Yeah, you did. But, so mine was the boxing. So I put the mental response to that into the boxing. Other people do it, whatever talents they've got, academic, politics, whatever it is, they do it. And then, so you make a best, you turn a bad thing into a good. You know, you respond to the bad with a good situation, yeah? And, so I have an overview of the whole thing, my own belief system. I have an overview, you know, of the thing. And so you do the right thing, whatever's best thing. You think the right thing to do, then do it. And if you can't do it, you can talk about it. It's always, dialogue's very good. Excellent. Well, it's the best in it. Dialogue, to talk it out. You talk about Winston Churchill, you know. Winston Churchill, he was a line, I'd say like one-liners, you know, and you can use them subjectively for whatever you want, obviously, and I'm using them for me, which is good, because he said, George War is better than World War. Now, these are people who can war. When I say these people is the human race. So we can all war, the four corners of the world. But he said, George War is better than World War. And that's what I believe myself, you know. So as long as you're alive, you can endure, talk, dialogue. Now, some people would rather go to war than talk, because especially if their argument's getting beat, then the ego's on the line then. So you've got a self-centered battle, you know, with yourself. So is it for me, I want to do it good, or is it for, you know, for my fellow man, you know, what's best for them?
Yeah.
So there's an overall view, as I said, I'm talking for me, so the view of it. And the world's the world. I'm not going to change people do what they want to do and how they do it and why they do it. And I try to see a view from my own higher view.
Sure. Well, John, I really enjoyed this, and I'm really grateful for your time. And it's been an absolute privilege to speak to someone who is remembered not only as one of Liverpool's, if not the finest fighter out of Liverpool, and one of Britain's very best ever. Happy to be remembered as one of those, as one of the British greats of all time.
Absolutely, yeah, great to be. Thanks for asking me to be involved in it, and yeah, it's just a great, it's a buzz, you know. Life and the world, and just do the best we can.
And you're still in good nick.
Yeah, I run 5 miles every day, then the alarm goes off.
As you wake up. Lovely. Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time, John. I'm really grateful.
Thanks, Chris. Yes.
All the best, man.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So there we have John Conti. It was great to get him talking so openly about the battles he faced after boxing. You know, something that we don't shy away from on this podcast. It is a challenge. Obviously, John spoke openly there about his ongoing battle with alcoholism, and the fact that that's played such a big role in his life. And he should be commended for doing everything that he's done to tackle that. Something that he's been he's had under control since the early 80s. John, I mean, it's hard to say, you know, we talked about so many different topics there. We talked about mental health and depression. We obviously talked about the drink. We talked about the glory nights. We talked about the 70s and those great nights and that great era. I understand what John's saying there, where he says about leaving it to journalists and writers to sort of break down other people's styles and stuff. But people do love the sound bites. Even if you just give a few words, you know, if I was to say Matthew Saad Muhammad, you know, we play like name, like word association with a name and then a few words and stuff. But John was sort of seemed reluctant to do that. And I get that, you know, it's perhaps not his place to break people's styles down. And maybe he did enough of that back in the day. Interested to hear the fallout with George Francis. I read John's book, I, Conti, years and years and years ago, and he does talk about the party lifestyle, should we say. And also, what I was also surprised about was how forgiving he was for, like, the loss to Mate Parlov, which was so controversial, which he said was one of the best nights of his career. And then obviously being so forgiving of the cut man, Adolf Ratako, in the first Saad Muhammad fight, and why, you know, years down the line, it still doesn't bother him. And I get that. And I mean, I've had a bit of a dive into some old boxing news around the time of the rematch. And apparently the rematch got him and Matthew so much more money that maybe that did soften the blow. The fact that, you know, he made a fortune for the rematch. So maybe that's why he was sort of more accepting of what happened in the first fight, because, you know, he was hard done by in the first fight. Not necessarily on the scores in the end, although there are plenty of people that think they were dubious, but the fact that Matthew Saad could even stay in the fight as long as he did with the cuts that he had through the stuff, cement-like content that was rammed into his cuts to keep them from causing the fight to be stopped. I don't know, it's tough. I thought that was a bit of a roller coaster from John. I thought sometimes he really fancied it and sometimes he didn't so much. And it was strange, but it was good. I mean, all these things are people's journeys, and I think we get a real good sense of... And I thought, you know, obviously what a way to sum up in terms of where his family came from, where his parents came from, and how he wound up getting a medal from the Queen. I mean, if there's one bullet point to sum up boxing, really, it's that. You know, from such a big family, from parents, from immigrant parents, massive family, brought up, let's say, on a budget in Liverpool, all the way up to meeting the Queen, sort of tells you all about what boxing can do to people from all kinds of backgrounds. And that's good enough for me. So I mentioned earlier, I'm back on the road. I'm actually going to see Spencer Oliver this week. Spencer and I have talked about doing a podcast for a long time. I've been a guest on his Pound for Pound podcast that he does with Jake Wood. And I said for the longest time, I've returned the favor, and I'm looking forward to it because I've known Spencer a long time, always got on well with him, always liked to chat with him. And we have plenty of lighthearted and serious things to discuss. So I'm looking forward to being back in person with people next week. Like I said earlier, we're deep into the 90s now with our episodes. There were certainly times before Hanson Lee and Delco Safety came on board that I didn't think we'd make this. By the time I'd done about 23 for free and travelled here, there and everywhere and amassed a lot of expenses on trains and fuel and all the rest of it, I didn't think we'd get here. But here we are, ploughing towards 100, looking forward to being back in person with Spencer next week. Huge thanks to John Conti for coming on this week and being so open. And a reminder, I mentioned there about Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm in 2020. That was at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And I'll be back next week, hopefully, fingers crossed, with the Omen, Spencer Oliver.